Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the man talking in your backswing, Charlie Nance.
Hey there, welcome back once again. We're Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. Well, this is the week of the year's third major, the 147th Open Championship, being contested at what's usually regarded as one of, if not the toughest golf course in the world, Carnoustie Golf Links in Scotland. I say usually because this is unlike any Carnoustie I believe any of us have seen. Normally, this course gets plenty of water from Mother Nature, not irrigation. Don't kid yourself. They haven't heard of that in Scotland yet, apparently. Anyway, the rough is usually green, lush, and plentiful, i.e. penal should you get in it. And the wind, well, it blows hard, and it blows often, and it blows in 80 million different directions. In 1999, six over got you in a playoff to win the championship. Now, conditions and scoring were better the last time the Open was contested there. In 2007, 7-under made the playoff. But the way the links are baked out right now, I'm looking for double that to be needed to win, at minimum. I mean, reports of 5-irons traveling 333 yards are not even raising an eyebrow over there this week. That's a big old bowl of wow. Now, I mentioned the 1999 Open Championship. If I say the name Jan van de Velde, everyone goes, oh, yeah, and remembers his three-stroke debacle on the last hole that cost him the championship. However, I'm willing to bet that if I asked you who won or who was in the playoff with van de Velde and the guy who won, a good many of you would struggle to remember the names of Paul Laurie and Justin Leonard. This week, we'll have a discussion about the phenomenon of remembering a major more for who lost than who won with golf historian Peter Kessler. Also, dang if the USGA didn't get one right this year. The inaugural U.S. Senior Women's Open was contested at Chicago Golf Club last week and by all accounts was a roaring success. On the grounds from thegolfnewsnet.com was our friend Ryan Ballingy, and we'll get his thoughts. Also, we're now a couple of months removed from what has to be one of, if not the most successful, Wells Fargo championships ever. And that tournament at Quail Hollow has, starting next year, one of the sweetest spots on the PGA Tour calendar that one could ask for. We'll check in with tournament director Gary Soba to get his two cents, but we begin with golf historian Peter Kessler. Peter, the Open Championship returns to Carnoustie this week, and in watching a replay of van de Velde's meltdown in 99 and then Sergio's missed opportunities in 07, it occurred to me that this venue in particular, and a lot of majors in general, we remember more for who didn't win rather than who did. Paul Laurie won in 99, Harrington in 07. Is this sort of thing more likely to happen at certain venues, or does venue not matter, you think?
I don't think the venue matters. It's, you know, it's the pressure. It's the coming together of particular personalities. It depends on the time in their career. I mean, you know, I was there at Carnoustie in 99, and I watched the whole thing, and I did a show with Jan van de Velde, and I had never, you know, I had probably 8,000 guests on those shows at the Golf Channel over time, and I had never asked anybody to sign anything except for Jan van de Velde. And I gave him the cover of Golf World magazine where he was standing in the burn with his pants legs rolled up, and in French he wrote, "From the silly man in the water." You know, loveliest, loveliest guy. Obviously, you know, didn't know what was going to happen to him and internally that would cause him to ultimately make bad decisions at the last few minutes. And, of course, he didn't have a caddy who knew any better either. And, you know, if you or I had been the caddy, we would have thrown all the clubs away except for the 8-iron, the sand wedge, and the putter and said, hit the 8-iron 3 times, chip if you have to, 2-putt, and get out of there. It's always been my conviction about Jan van de Velde that the 3-shot lead is what hurt him. If he'd had a 2-shot lead, he would have played for a safe bogey. With a 3-shot lead, something inside you says, no problem, I've got this covered. 2 shots, 3 shots. Huge difference in strategy, huge difference in philosophy. And I don't think it's ever really the course. I think it's the moment. and some people don't rise to the occasion where they have previously risen before. And that's what makes it all so fascinating.
You talked with John Vandeveld. I'm sure over time you had a chance to visit with Paul Lawrie. I almost feel for the people who do win these that sort of go down as, oh, yeah, and he won. How does Paul Lawrie feel about that championship?
Well, I mean, you know, internally he's thrilled that he won it, but he also knows that he never really should have been in it. And he hates the fact that he is recognized as, oh, by the way, as a trivia question, do you remember who actually won the year that John Vandeveld made the seven on the final hole? And the answer is most people don't. And even fewer people could tell you that Justin Leonard was also in the playoff. So, no, I don't feel like Paul Lawrie went out and won it. I think it was just gifted to him. And he ended up playing, the few good holes in the playoff, and he was the winner, and he did turn in the lowest score when the whole thing was done, including the playoff. So, yes, he's the champion, but no, it's not going to go down. It's one of the really cool victories.
Not to pick on the Open Championship, Peter, but I wonder how many remember Stuart Sink winning and not Tom Watson losing in 09. And what sets this one apart for me, as opposed to the other ones we're going to talk about, is I don't think Tom Watson choked. He hit a nail of a hybrid off the tee on 18. He hit a beautiful 9-iron, absolutely flush to the middle of that green. And in fact, you can argue he hit it too well. And then I feel like he got a bad break. Or am I romanticizing it?
Well, no. What happened was that, Tom had a distance into 18 with the pin back that if he crushes the 9-iron, it may only get a third of the way into the green, leaving a 60-footer. If it's the 8-iron too firm, you bring in trouble at the back of the green. So Tom decided that he would hit a 3/4 8-iron, and it was the right play. I was standing right there. And when he did that, as he was making his club selection, I moved quickly towards the green, and he hit the shot perfectly. It only landed a few feet onto the green, but it caught a downslope of one of the very rare downslopes on that green, and that's what propelled it forward. And I remember watching Watson standing in the fairway, listening. People are going, yes, 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 and then, oh, the groan. So he knew it went over the backside. And then he violated his own rule about playing that shot. He had a very difficult, short, deft pitch to play back to the hole, and he did what a recreational golfer would have done to try to make sure of his bogey, which is, okay, I'm going to putt this, I'm going to knock it 10 feet by the hole, and I'm going to take my two putts, I'm going to get my five and get out of here. And one of the greatest chippers of all time, and this is why you can understand how Vandeveld imploded, five-time major champion of the Open Championship, decided to play the wrong shot because he was afraid to play the right shot because he didn't think he could pull it off. And he and I discussed this, and of course, this is, I knew it at the time, and he, of course, confirmed it later. And I said to him, it just must have been incredibly deflating internally to be able to then try to get yourself geared up for the playoff. And he said, I wasn't ready for it, and I played like Sam Sausage. But it was a tremendously unfair links-type break, and we're going to see a lot of that this week.
Golf historian Peter Kessler is our guest taking Dead Aim. A couple of famous instances of this sort of thing happening occurred in the 60s. In 66, the U.S. Open at Olympic Club in San Francisco, Palmer, a 7-shot lead with 9 to go and lost to Billy Casper. You know, in a way, kind of like I feel sorry for Stuart Sink and him taking that away from Tom Watson. I've always felt bad for Casper. It's remembered more for Arnold's collapse. And in an era of the Big Three, you can make an argument that Billy C was as good as any of them on any given day and a legendary putter. And, even though you can say, okay, Palmer let that one slip away, Billy Casper was not Sam Sausage.
Oh, and listen, Billy Casper is one of the greatest players who ever lived. He won 51 times in the era of the Big Three on the PGA Tour hitting a cut, and then he won 10 times more on the Senior Tour hitting a draw. And, really, that tournament is completely different than thinking of the Sink-Watson thing, because nobody cares about Sink, including Sink's people and Sink. Everybody wanted Watson to win except two or three people. And Sink knows that he made a terrible mistake winning that championship and that he'll never get the recognition. And there wasn't one person on the grounds that day who literally was rooting for him. In the case of the Casper situation, first of all, in the second half of the 60s, from 66 through 70, through 69, Billy Casper actually won more golf tournaments than Jack, Arnold, or Gary during that five-year period when they were all in their prime. So in 1966, when, you know, Casper is playing in the final round with Arnold, you know, at that point, Casper had won an Open at Wingfoot in 1959 and had already demonstrated he was one heck of a player. And he wasn't afraid of Arnold at all, and they stood on the 10th tee, and Arnold had the seven-shot lead, and Billy said, boy, I'm going to really have to go to get second, Arnold. And Arnold said, no, you can do it. I'll help you, Bill. Don't worry about it. We're going to get you there. And then, of course, what happened was Arnold, instead of just trying to close out the golf tournament, and he had closed out a lot of them, instead of trying to close out the golf tournament, for some reason he fixated on Hogan's U.S. Open scoring record, and he knew if he shot a really good number on the final nine that he would break that record that actually Jack Nicklaus would break the next year at Baltusrol, but playing against Arnold in the final round when Arnold shot 69 but Jack shot 65, including getting it up and down with a one iron from 218 yards on the last hole to go ahead and break the Hogan record. So Arnold was distracted. So they get to 13. Arnold misses the green. It's a par 3. Billy holds a putt for a 2. They get to 15. Arnold misses the green, a par 3. Billy holds a putt for 2, where Arnold makes bogey. They go to 16, the par 5. Arnold makes an incredible bogey, after snapping a shot off of the tee and actually hit his fourth shot with a 3-wood and then got it up and down out of a bunker for bogey. But Casper made birdie. And then you come to 18, and it looked like actually Casper would win it outright because Arnold was in such deep rough on the left side of the 18th hole that it was actually considered the deepest rough on the golf course. And Billy told me later that Arnold played what he said was the most fantastic shot with a 9-iron, and the divot was a foot long. And Arnold hit the green and still had to shake in a really nasty four-footer, and it was continuous putting option at that point in professional golf. So Billy said to Arnold, yeah, go ahead and knock in your four-footer. You're warm. This is literally what he said. And Arnold shook the thing in, and same thing repeated itself the next day. Arnold took the lead on the front nine, then came to the back nine, and then Casper just, you know, played a lot better than Arnold did. But in the fourth round, Billy shot 32 on the back nine. Arnold shot 39 on the back nine. Hence, the seven shots got gobbled up. And I've talked to both of them about it many, many, many times. And I think it was either 1999 or 2000. Billy and Arnold and I all had lunch together over at Bay Hill, and we talked about that for 30 minutes. And Arnold said to Billy, he said, I'm so sick of them making me go back to Olympic Club and Oakmont and all these places that I've lost golf tournaments. And Casper said, Arnold, if you hadn't have done what you did the way you did it, and I didn't do what I did the way that I did it, he said, nobody would have ever talked about it. He said, you and I have kept this thing propped up for the rest of our lives. And he said, and you've won enough major championships and enough golf tournaments for 10 people. He said, I don't feel bad for you at all, even though when I put my arm around you after the playoff on the last day, I whispered in your ear, I'm sorry, Arnold, and you couldn't say anything. And Arnold said, I still can't.
Golf historian Peter Kessler is our guest taking Dead Aim. Before we get to what I think is the most infamous of all of these occurrences, let's stay with the Olympic Club and fast forward about 32 years. With time, I like the way that history has remembered Payne Stewart. You have the lasting images of Pinehurst and him cradling Phil's face and saying, you're going to be a father. I mean, every time I go to Pinehurst, I look at the statue. I love the way time remembers Payne Stewart. A lot of people forget that he let a lot of tournaments slip his way coming up. And in 98 at Olympic, it was his on his racket. He got a bad break with a divot on the backside, and Lee Jansen won his second U.S. Open. But that also is an Open that's remembered for who lost and not won.
Well, especially since he'd already previously lost another U.S. Open to Lee Jansen. So it was more than doubly painful. And I got all over Payne's case, you know. We're sitting and doing a TV show, and he's giving me the business about the divot. And I said, you're a stiff. I said, I'm a 6 handicapper. I said, I could have played that shot to the middle of the green with my eyes closed. I said, you had a 9-iron. For goodness gracious, what kind of a shot were you trying to hit? If you're in a divot, you play it back, you knock it to the middle of the green, you take your 2 putts, and you get out of town. And you're trying to hit some kind of a goofy golf shot, and then you just decel into the ground behind it. I said, that was like an 18 handicapper. And he said, more like a 20. So he totally knew that was a bunch of garbage, and he did get screwed on a pin that was very poorly set by, well, as always, by the USGA, and in that case, Tom Meeks. And the people who do it now are as bad or worse than Tom Meeks. I mean, they've had 14 years to improve on the Meeks stuff, and they're just more horrible every single year, including last week's U.S. Senior Women's Open, when they have players like Betsy King shooting 85. What is the point? Betsy King shoots 68 at home. You take the Chicago golf course, where they played the oldest 18-hole golf course in America, and you make it so, so difficult that only the three active players can actually play the course. Collectively, they are mindless. This absurd notion of protecting par at all costs with a bunch of little old ladies.
Literally.
Seriously, shame on you.
How would we assess Jansen's career? He had 8 wins, 2 U.S. Opens, but only 1 top 5 in a major outside of those 2 wins. How do you assess Lee Jansen's career?
Very nice. That's it. I mean, you know, you can't make a big deal out of this. I mean, I said to Jack Nicklaus, what do you think of Mickelson's career? And he said, he's a nice player. So if Phil's a nice player, what's Lee Jansen? 2 U.S. Opens is fantastic. You know, it's as hard a tournament as there is to win. You live for major championships. 1 is super. 2 is unbelievable. 8 wins is not enough. You need 20 wins and a minimum of 2 majors. But he'll be remembered as a really super-duper iron player and a really good player around the greens and a really good clutch player who just somehow lost his game.
Golf historian Peter Kessler, our guest, taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here on this. I've saved this, what I think, the best for last on this subject, the 68 Masters. The reigning Open champion, Roberto DiVincenzo, signs an incorrect scorecard and thereby surrendering the Masters title to Bob Golby. I know that you have spoken with both men on this subject. How did that affect them both?
Well, I mean, it was a really crazy thing in terms of the way it ultimately, you know, unwound itself. First of all, obviously, because Roberto signed for a higher score than he shot, he was stuck with it, and they didn't have a playoff, and Golby would have liked the playoff, and a lot of people said, you know, Golby should have insisted or that he wasn't going to take the jacket. You don't put yourself above the rules. You don't tell the committee how to handle the rules of golf, and so Golby did exactly the right thing. He offered to play it off. They said, you can't do that under the rules. He accepted the jacket as the winner. And he and Roberto had known each other at that point for a long time. And the interesting thing is, Roberto and Golby both played together on Saturday the day before. And when the round ended, Golby passed DiVincenzo's scorecard to Roberto to sign. He said Roberto didn't even look at it. He said he just signed it. And he said, I'd never really seen that before. He said, you know, the holy grail is you've got to check it hole by hole. He said, I knew I got it right, so there wasn't a risk of my being wrong. He said, but Roberto's supposed to check it. And he said, so the next day, again, he said, I knew he didn't check his scorecard. So I said to Roberto, did you really not look at your scorecard on Sunday? And he said, I did. He said, but the only thing I could see when I looked at the card was the 5 on the 18th hole, the bogey. I didn't see that Tommy Aaron, who kept my score, had given me a 4 on 17 instead of the 3 that I made. So I had to live with the 4. But I couldn't get my eyes off of the 5. And starting that day, I never didn't look at a scorecard as thoroughly as I might do ever, ever again. And he said, but he said, you know, I get so much publicity out of it. He said, people have been so good to me over the years. He said, I almost feel like I won and that Bob got the short end because so many people criticized him because he didn't insist that we have a playoff or said that he wasn't a true champion because I lost on a technicality. He said, he won. He said he won. That's the end of it. He said, he's the one who got the short end of this. He said, for me, he said, people love me for my whole life.
I literally could talk golf with that guy for days. That's golf historian Peter Kessler. And when we return, what's it like to be at a USGA event that the USGA doesn't screw up? TheGolfNewsNet.com's Ryan Ballingee takes Dead Aim at the U.S. Senior Women's Open, presented by the Charlotte Office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We're taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte Office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Joining us now, Ryan Ballingee of TheGolfNewsNet.com, who was on site in Chicago for last week's U.S. Senior Women's Open. Ryan, you were like me, and I guess like all of us, heading into last weekend, I didn't know what to expect from the U.S. Senior Women's Open. First off, I want you to describe to me and for everyone Chicago Golf Club. I mean, this is an original five USGA club. It's uber private. It's a gym. Not many of us have seen it before. What were your first impressions?
Blown away. I mean, you don't even know that it's there. I mean, to kind of describe it, yeah, you know, the USGA, obviously, this is a low-key event. They're not expecting 30,000 people a day, but they had parking at a middle school, and then you get on a bus and you go over and like, okay, well, it's got to be somewhere. I mean, there's got to be signage or, you know, something that stands out in Wheaton, like, hey, Chicago Golf Club's here. And you get there, and it's like, it just seems so understated, probably by design. They don't want people walking by and gawking, but then you kind of walk past the clubhouse, which has got to be 110, 115 years old, and you walk onto the golf course and you're just blown away by a lot of different things. I mean, one, by the lack of trees. I mean, it's all trees everywhere in Wheaton until you get onto that golf course. And then just the golden brown throughout the property, because, I mean, you're basically in fairway light rough sand, or you're in the high stuff, the wispy stuff. And because of the way the summer had gone for them, it was just beautifully brown. But the thing that really blew me away walking around the golf course was the strategy involved in every shot. And in particular, why it was such a great fit for the first U.S. Senior Women's Open, they played at about 6,200 yards, and almost every single cross bunker that was put there either by McDonald or in Rainer's redesign was in play. It was exactly how the golf course was intended to play. The green complexes, a lot of shots were uphill to kind of protect distances at that time when it was designed. That was the best they could do to make it feel a little bit longer. And all the holes feel simple. You're walking along, you're like, this really should be pretty easy. But given the shots and given the distances that the senior ladies were hitting from, and then the green complexes that you get to, which are way more complicated than they first look, it's just a perfect golf design. It's a perfect test. Enough room for you to be able to do pretty much anything you want to do, take on any challenge you want to take on. But if you don't take it on successfully, you pay dearly. And that's exactly what a great golf course should be.
I'm glad you brought up the distance. This is one of the things I wanted to ask you. It played at 6,200 yards, and I watched the entire final round on FS1, and it appeared to me that Inkster and especially Laura Davies, they just overpowered it at 6,200 yards. Yeah. Was that a good distance? Was it too short? Do they need to think about increasing that distance as we go forward? I mean, on the other hand, there were only three players who broke par of the whole field, so maybe it was better than I thought.
I think it's an awkward case, because you have to remember, I mean, you got Joanne Carner, who's 79 years old on one end of the field, and you've got Julie Inkster and Laura Davies, who still have a lot of pop in the bat, well above 50 years old, and you're trying to accommodate both sets of people and everywhere in between. So you've got these younger, by comparison, players who are in their early 50s who still have swing speeds and still can contend on the LPGA. I mean, Julie Inkster is not far removed from being a third-round leader on the LPGA. Laura Davies was a end-of-round leader this season on the LPGA. So they still have plenty of distance to keep up with their much younger peers on the LPGA. So I think they tried to do their best to strike a balance. And they probably could have stretched the golf course out to about 6,500 yards, my guess. I don't know the full scorecard, but that based on the tees they didn't use, that's kind of where I could put it. And I think you would almost make it impossible to have a story like Joanne Carner to make the cut. So I think they wanted to make it fair for everybody, recognizing that the younger players closer to 50 who were still, you know, still have high swing speeds for their peers were probably going to have a good chance to take it over if they had a good driving week.
Ryan Ballingy with thegolfnewsnet.com is our guest taking Dead Aim. Thank you for bringing up Joanne Carner. She was my favorite story, and I think everyone's favorite story for the first couple of days. Shot her age, 79 on Thursday, and she's beyond classic. I mean, she still likes her cocktails in a highball glass over ice. She's dragging on a heater right before she tees off and flicks it away. I mean, how completely classic was Joanne Carner?
Oh, my God. I just want to take her home and make her my third grandma. she's so fun to watch play golf. And Beth Ann Nichols had a really great tweet describing her on-range routine, something to the effect of hit a ball, rip a dart, throw the dart down, hit two more, drag the dart again. It was just, oh, it was so good. And it was really cool to see the galleries get behind her. I was only there on Friday, but was there when she teed off on 10 for the second round. just the ovation for her and for Holly Stacey and Sandra Palmer for that matter was just excellent. I mean, people wanted to see her get to the weekend, and that she almost got there is pretty special. And that she was annoyed she didn't was even cooler. And she said, hey, I'm coming back next year at 80. They're going to be at Pine Needles next May. So it'll be less than a year till we see this tournament again. And I fully expect she'll give herself a chance. I mean, she hadn't walked a golf course in 14 years. I mean, she's played golf, but it's been in a cart. So she walked 3 practice rounds leading into it, and she walked 2 rounds. And you tell me, if you haven't played golf in a while and you play 5 times in 5 days, whether it's on a vacation or with friends or whatever, you're busted at the end. So imagine being a 79-year-old lady who's been ripping darts for the last 14 years without walking a golf course. And you tell me if you'd be tired. So I find it even more remarkable that she got through the whole thing, her head pretty well above water. And she did her game a great service by the way that she played.
With zero TV coverage until the weekend, by the way, be better on that, Fox. I was left to read your and other accounts of what was happening. And as I was looking over the field, I told Ron Cyrak last week, I got the same feeling as when I was a kid and watched the original Legends of Golf tournament on TV in Austin, where you saw players that you'd only heard about. And this was like a who's who in the days gone by in women's golf. I hadn't seen names like Laura Baugh and Jan Stevenson in years, and all of a sudden I saw them on the tee sheet. And the only name I was disappointed to see not competing was Nancy Lopez, but turns out she was there, right?
She was. She was the honorary first tee starter. So she had, I can't remember if it was her left or right knee done as a replacement earlier in the year, and she's recovering from that. She's going to have the second knee done soon, and then she hopes to play next year for this. So it was really cool that even though she couldn't play, she came, she was a part of it, she was an emotional part of it. I mean, she walked around all week, she took pictures with a lot of people. It was really cool. And like you said, I mean, I never saw Pat Bradley play in person. I never saw Laura Ball play in person. She was just kind of a legend that I've heard about. It was really cool to watch them play. And even people you've never heard of, and my example is Susie Green Roebuck, who finished, I think, like T10. I mean, she had a great week. She won the Michigan Women's PGA like 3 times, and no one's ever done that. And I do not know this by heart. I had to look that up. But I caught up to her in 12. She hit a bomb drive. And she's just walking up the fairway with her kids and her husband, just talking about golf and having a fun time. And she took a picture with her son in the fairway, and crowds were able to walk in the fairway or the rough, whatever, just had to be respectful of the player's space. And then she went from being a mom right back to being a golfer and hit one up close to the green that made birdie. So, I mean, it was really cool to see cases like that. Not even the most famous legends you can think of, but also really high quality golfers over the age of 50 who never had this outlet before and were left to build their legend in state tournaments or PGA section tournaments. And now they've got something that they can come to year after year and flex their muscle. I think that's great.
TheGolfNewsNet.com's Ryan Ballingy is our guest taking dead aim. Before we get off Nancy Lopez, look, to me, she's not just Hall of Famer. She's LPGA Mount Rushmore. There's not a classier lady in the game than Nancy Lopez. And I was thinking to myself, I can't imagine a male equivalent of Nancy Lopez, quote-unquote, lowering themselves to be the starter at an event like this. But it just showed me how classy she is and how she knew how important this event was for the future of women's golf and for this to carry on. And she made it a point to be a part of it. And it just spoke to me of why she's on Mount Rushmore.
Absolutely. I walked the front nine. I walked the back nine first just to get a feel of the lay of the land. And then a buddy of mine, Jane Crafter, who I'd never met in person until Friday, I followed her for the front nine. And we finally, after she made her second birdie in a row, we finally introduced ourselves to each other. And we were talking about Nancy. And she said, you know, there's supposedly 13 founders of the LPGA. Nancy Lopez is the 14th founder of the LPGA. She's done so much for this game, for the LPGA, for women's golf advancement, getting it into the public consciousness, and she continues to do it day after day, even though she's not an active LPGA player anymore. She's still a huge ambassador for the sport and probably will never relent that because she feels it's that important to her. And that's why she was on the first tee. That's why she was doing that for the first 2 days, you know, for the days of the championship, because she wanted that to feel special for the 120 women in the field. And for a number of those women, obviously Nancy was a peer or was maybe a little Ruttiger in the case of Joanne Garner when Nancy came along. But it was important to her to be there, to be a presence, and to add whatever importance and weight could be there by her being there, even if it wasn't in a playing capacity. And like we said, hopefully she plays next year and gets announced by someone else, and maybe that'll start some kind of tradition for this tournament. I think a number of traditions could be started by this championship that will be really special and hopefully maybe carry through to other USGA ones. That includes having a legend as the first tee starter, having the crowds there, which are obviously not large, but were way bigger than expected, walk the fairways and the rough and be right up next to the players if they can be, and give a great experience to the people who show up and make it something that moms and dads can bring their kids to come watch these legends play and make it a special experience and show them just how great they were. And just like I would have a conversation with my son about golf or about the All-Star game, I'm here in D.C. tonight, but, you know, the All-Star game, the legends I used to watch play baseball in person. We can have that conversation with our kids about golf, and it doesn't have to be these guys are great. It could be these people were great. These women were fantastic as well, and they still are. And I think that's an important thing to be able to pass along is the history of the sport.
Ryan, one thing I'm curious about is the vibe among the spectators at the U.S. Senior Women's Open. It was one of the more interesting things that I've seen in that there didn't appear to be rope number one on the golf course. Now, granted, this wasn't an event that had 60,000 patrons. I get it. But there was something really neat about seeing the spectators literally either walking stride for stride or just two strides behind the competitors right down the middle of the fairway.
The only places there were ropes were around the green complexes and the tees. I didn't want you standing on those things. But other than that, you could pretty much go where you wanted. Again, so long as you kept a respectful distance from the players. I think most everyone that's a golf fan probably knows what that is. And at different times, you know, every group had different size crowds, some as little as like 2, some 10, some 30. And then you had the kind of Joanne Garner group was maybe closer to 100. But when I went and followed Jane, I mean, the group in front of us, they were sitting on the like grass behind bunkers in the fairway just to watch these shots go. So it was really cool to be able to just see that up front. And in a lot of cases, the players wanted to interact with the fans, whether it be like the Susie Green Robot case of, hey, this is actually my literal family, or they were just, and Laurie Atsides, who was a longtime veteran of the LPGA, said this, Jane Crafter was like, hey, it's a little weird, but at least they're watching us. They're here to watch us play. And that's really cool. So, I think most of the players embrace it. And I think that's something I hope the USGA embraces moving forward that maybe sets this championship apart from the others. That, yes, this is special and unique. And, yes, you can see the greatest female players you've ever seen go 5 feet from them and watch them hit an incredible shot. I mean, that's what made it special to me.
Ryan Ballingy, thegolfnewsnet.com, our guest taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here on this. Give me three things that you loved most about this event and one or two things that you think they can improve moving forward.
I'll give the one or two improvements first. TV coverage, obviously. I mean, tape delayed coverage of the final round. Part of that was weather related, I understand. But to give just 4 hours of coverage and relegated to FS1 and to not have in the booth, and as much as I like Brad Faxon, to not have a legend from the women's side of the game in the booth with Shane Bacon, I thought that was a big misstep on their part. And I think that probably stemmed from the fact that they had no idea how many people would care about this tournament, and it turns out it was way more than they thought. I think all the other things are positive. I would like to see, I guess, the one negative is I would like to see more legendary players take part in this next year if they can. I would love to see getting Dottie Pepper and Beth Daniel and a couple of other players to be a part of this. If they can and when they're able to participate. We're just a few years away from being able to have Annika play in this. I think she's 47 or 48, so just a few years away from that happening, which will be incredible. Other than that, I think they hit it out of the park, and I don't say that a lot about the USGA.
I was going to say, did you just say the USGA hit something out of the park?
But they nailed it. They made the players feel special. They gave them courtesy cars. That doesn't happen on the Legends Tour. And for most of their careers, it didn't happen on the LPGA Tour. They gave them $1 million purse, which I know sounds like peanuts compared to the $4.2 million that the senior men were playing for at the Broadmoor, but it's a start. And that's a respectable amount of money compared to what they play for the Legends Tour, more than double what they play for in the Legends Tour. in the four or five events that they do. So I think that they nailed it. And I think if they continued along this path for a few years, let it bubble up and develop, and let that nuance of kind of it being a competitive championship versus being a novelty kind of work itself out over time, and then it becomes a serious, big competition. Not that it wasn't serious, but an even bigger deal than it is in terms of the competitive aspect of it. And they're going to have a really special championship on their hands that is going to be a niche cult favorite for years to come.
Next year, the U.S. Senior Women's Open is at Pine Needles, and I will be there. From thegolfnewsnet.com, that's Ryan Ballingy. Up next, where are we now with the Wells Fargo Championship? Tournament director Gary Soba takes dead aim at his first year on the job, a hugely successful tournament by all accounts, and the Wells Fargo Championship's place on the new PGA Tour schedule, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. We are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And I've looked forward since the tournament ended to checking in with Wells Fargo Championship Tournament Director Gary Soba. Gary, from hope to expectation to reality, what was the overall feeling you had about your first year helming the Wells Fargo Championship as the last patrons left the ground of Quail Hollow on that Sunday in May?
That's a really good question. And, you know, we felt comfortable and good going in, but I think we exceeded expectations. I think on a 1 to 10, it felt like about a 12. You know, we're very fortunate. We had a great field already. And then the previous Thursday, or prior to the tournament, when Tiger committed, and then, you know, we had Chamber of Commerce weather led to largest Saturday crowd, largest Friday crowd we've ever had. So I just felt like, you know, it went out of the park in every way, shape, and form. And it was just an awesome week.
You know, this was not your field of expertise when you came into this. What was the most unexpected thing? The thing that you would have never thought to prepare for about this job that you discovered in year one?
You know, it's interesting. I've been in event management, so I'm going to say two things. One, nothing unbelievably shocking happened with one exception, and then I was talking to one of our marshals, one of our volunteers on 17, and right beside me had a seizure. So I think that's the first thing. You know, within 90 seconds, we had paramedics there. And it's amazing what a great job our volunteers do. And fortunately, the gentleman he's healthy, and he was able to go home the next day. He was taken to the hospital that day. So that was obviously a negative. But overall, I think my biggest surprise is there weren't surprises.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, I like the fact that CPR needed to be part of the job interview.
Of course, he didn't have to have that, but there was actually in the second row, there was a doctor nearly right beside him. So we were very, very fortunate, and all our volunteers had the paramedics there quickly. So I was just so impressed by how the entire operation worked.
That's stunning. You found a doctor at a golf course. That's like saying you found a blade of grass at a golf course. Gary Soba is the tournament director of the Wells Fargo Championship. He's our guest taking dead aim. You know, every job has its great rewards, and most of them are actually not tangible. For example, there's lots of things in the radio business that at this point I can take or leave, but I still love being on the air every day. I still love preparing to do so. I love doing this golf show. What is the one thing about your job that you look back a year later and you say, you know what, I really love doing this?
I love leading a team. I think that's one thing, but I love developing relationships with players. And now following players. For instance, I'll use a couple of examples. You know, local Harold Varner. You know, I follow Harold every week and watching what he's done the last couple of weeks.
Oh, it's been so great.
You know, exactly. And then there's, you know, a player like a Bryson DeChambeau. I went the next week to the players, and Harold and Bryson were both playing a Tiger in a practice round, and they saw me and they came over. And I thought that was pretty special that in year one, you know, they didn't necessarily seek me out, but once they saw me, they felt very comfortable, and you know, Tiger was with them. So I thought that was pretty cool.
We'll get to Tiger here in a second. You know, the numbers aren't officially out. We're not going to discuss them. But I feel it's safe to say that this was a pretty good year at the Wells Fargo Championship, and a huge reason you mentioned the return of Tiger Woods. You know, it's been a while since I'd been at a regular tour event that he was present. I'd been to majors, but not a regular tour event in a long time where he'd been there. And I'd forgotten what it was like. I don't know if you'd felt it before, but can you speak about the, I don't know, it's a palpable energy when he is on the property.
Well, you're correct. You can almost feel the ground move. I mean, when he's out there, when people are following him, or when he shows up to the first practice tee, I mean, you feel it. You can sense the energy, and you're right. He certainly impacts the tournament. It was interesting. I won't mention what player, but I mentioned talking about he moves the needle, and the player said, Gary, he is the needle. And the respect, the enormity of the respect they have for him and the way he handles himself, you know, he's beyond superstar. You know, he's probably, in our lifetime, he may be the biggest superstar of our lifetime. If not, he's certainly on a short list. And to see the respect the other players have for him and just to see how he handles himself, and it's just impressive. And yes, the crowds are massive following him. I will add, on Saturday, he was on 14 and Phil was on 17. And I've been to Augusta many times. I've never seen the enormity of the crowds that were at Quail Hollow. I've never seen them bigger at Augusta than when he was over on 14 and Phil was on 17 tee.
How was your dealing with Tiger and his people? There's infamous stories in the past from other tournaments about, you know, quirkiness and difficulty and whatnot. But I got the impression that it was a really easy marriage this time.
Yeah, and I don't want to overplay our hand because you know, hey, they make that choice whether to play or not, and we're certainly thankful he came. But, you know, it's a very cordial relationship. It's a very easy relationship, and you know, it's I say it's quite comfortable. But I don't want to overstate it that there's not unbelievable depth on our side. Hey, we are just very thankful he came, but his people are wonderful, and I know his publicist well, and they're very easy to deal with and really good folks.
Gary Sobas is the tournament director of the Wells Fargo Championship, our guest taking Dead Aim. I've found that over the years, it's easy to get caught up in the euphoria immediately after a successful event. And in fact, that can sometimes cloud your assessment and judgment moving forward. How long was it after the tournament that you and Mr. Harris and Mac sat down and said, okay, how'd we do?
We waited 2 to 3 weeks. And,
oh, that's a good time, yeah.
Yeah, and you don't have all the financials back in. For instance, concessions revenues, and those rose significantly. And once we kind of got an idea what the numbers are, and they're still not finalized, but, yeah, they're very good. They're very, very healthy, substantially more healthy than 16, which puts this tournament in very good position. I think everybody was really, really pleased. And, you know, it came off without a hitch. You know, the tournament went very, very well. So I feel like not it was only a success, it was a tremendous success.
You know, there are a couple things I've always admired about Mr. Harris. Number one is his unwavering enthusiasm for the game and this tournament. And two, his ability to never get complacent. He's always looked for ways to make the Wells Fargo Championship better, not just for the players or for the fans, the media, anyone involved. He's always looking to make it better. And this, of course, has a trickle-down effect to everyone who works with him and for him. What are a couple of things that you looked at this year and said, you know, this was good, but I think we can make it better?
Really, really good point. I think a couple things. One, we want to make the 14 green 15 tee area better. You know, it's around the lake, and we didn't have any chalets. Well, I give Johnny credit. They have moved 15 tee. They've moved it to the left, which is going to make the 15 tee ball harder for the pros. But it's now established an area where we're hoping to put, you know, a military pavilion or some sort of chalets over there and grow that area. So that's you know, a significant potential, because you're looking right down the barrel at 14, and you're a golfer. You know, 14 is where they can drive the par 4, and 15 is a great tee ball as well. So we're looking at those opportunities. We're also looking at perhaps opportunities with some video. Some opportunities where, you know, when you're on the green mile, you can see other parts of the golf course and watch video. So we're entertaining some options and thoughts there that, you know, you can sit there watching the green mile, but you also can see the golfers and leaders on the front side as well.
Gary, is it always a positive moving forward, or are there things that you may have tried and upon reflection you say, you know, maybe we should go a different way next time?
Well, I think there's always trial and error, but I don't think there was many errors this year. I think there's a few things we'll switch and change, but not many, which I think is a positive. And, you know, we'll continue to throw things on the wall. But our patrons, you know, they've done this now 16 years. I thought we'll make some changes to the executive club. I think we need to make it a little bit more luxurious than we have it currently. So we're gonna make some investment in that specific club. We may build a club on 17 tee called the Overlook Club, and then gonna make some changes there at 14 green 15 tee. So I think those are the most substantial things that you'll see in terms of what we're going forward in 19. But our corridor between 14 to 17 up there, and then 18 green, that's gonna be our focus. And it'll continue to be our focus because very few golf courses do you get three holes of viewing. If you're sitting on the 17 side, the 16 or 17 side of the lake, you can watch 14, you can watch the tee ball on 15, you get 16 and 17. There's not many golf courses in America you can watch four holes.
Oh, yeah, 14 green is my favorite place on the golf course. I can look across the lake and watch stuff. I can watch people drive to drive the par four. I can walk up on the hill and watch people tee off on the par five. I think that to me is the focal point of the Wells Fargo Championship as far as a patron viewing experience. I don't know if it was just me and if you heard this from a lot of people, but this was my guess 12th year going out to the Wells Fargo Championship, and this year. And I'm going to give you credit for this, as you were the new cog in the wheel here. I felt a whole renewed enthusiasm all over the golf course for the event from not just patrons but vendors. It seemed like everyone involved, there was a renewed sense of trying to make this the best it could be this year. Did you sense that?
Well, I appreciate you saying that. We certainly try to do that. You know, a dose of enthusiasm is important. And, you know, we try to really instill that in all our vendors, whether it's our marshals, our patrons, whether it's our concessionaire, and let them know, hey, that everyone is important. And, you know, adding the concerts and adding the Derby party, those things helped, and having the Wednesday night concert in Phillips Place. But we want to make this a year-round event that benefits charities throughout the Charlotte area. So our goal is to raise revenue. Obviously, we're a nonprofit, but our ability, if we can go out and continue to accrete the dollars and give more back to the community of Charlotte, it's a win-win for everybody. So I'm glad that you sense that, hey, when people came out, there was, I call it a dose of enthusiasm, because, you know, I think people are really excited. And let's face it, Tiger coming in, that added an extra buzz.
No question. Gary Sobas, the tournament director of the Wells Fargo Championship, our guest taking Dead Aim. All right, enough about where we've been. Let's talk about where we're going. The PGA Tour schedule for the 2018-2019 wraparound schedule came out last week, and in my opinion, the Wells Fargo Championship could not have picked a better spot if they bribed every official on the PGA Tour for life. You have the Masters, then you have Hilton Head, then the two-man event in New Orleans, then the Wells Fargo Championship, then 1 week, and then the PGA. The way I look at it, you're going to have a lot of players that are going to take the 2 weeks off after the Masters, just because after a major, they need that time to decompress. But then they're going to want to get things back in the groove before they head into the next major. What a sweet spot. Gary, come on, be honest. You got to love this.
Well, can you send that to all the players? Can I just go ahead and put it on the schedules already? I'd be happy to do that. But I think you make a good point. We are very thrilled about where we fall in the schedule. We knew what week we had, and we were pretty certain the things are going to take place behind it. But with the PGA move, it'll be at Bethpage next year. It'll be interesting because, you know, the Dallas tournament moved to a more of a link-style course, and you know, will players want to play that before they have to go to Bethpage, which primarily is a Bombers golf course. So we feel like we're in great position, and, you know, hopefully we'll have great weather and we know we'll have a great field. And I think this year we had our best field in about 10 years, and if they can get better than that, that's just going to be superlative for the community.
Well, you've got a championship venue, and I think that makes all the difference in the world heading into a major championship. If someone is wanting to get their game tuned up, you know, no offense to, you know, the tournament players course that they just got done playing in Iowa or wherever, but it's not Quail Hollow Club. It's not where they're going to contest a major championship. So I think that's going to help as well. In terms of recruiting, and I'm glad you brought it up, how much do you and your group have to do at this point? I mean, especially with the announcement of the new schedule. Is it something that you can't be complacent about? You're constantly having to check in with people, or how do you feel about that?
Yeah, we're very active there. Complacent's a good word. I'll go to the Northern Trust in August. We'll usually go to the Hero in early December. I'll either make it to San Diego or to Phoenix. And then usually to Valspar, and then we've got our parent company, ProLinx. You know, our CEO lives in South Florida, so he's in constant communication. But we're very intentional about that. You don't control players' schedules, but, you know, if they know they're going to have a great experience, if you talk about a couple of new things that are involved in the golf course, we just want to stay in front of them. And, you know, certainly for year one for me as a new tournament director, you know, I sent out Christmas gifts last year, wrote handwritten notes on the front side to the top 100 players plus others in the world. Post this tournament, I wrote 156 handwritten notes to every player who played here. So try to do all the little things that can impact the big things.
Tournament director of the Wells Fargo Championship, Gary Soba, is our guest, Taking Dead Aim. Get you out of here on this. I always try to pin you down with this question. You never let me, so I'm going to try a different tack. The PGA Tour doesn't like to do a big revamp schedule, only to have to go revamp it in the not-too-distant future. So, with that assumption in mind, can we also assume that annual golf on the PGA Tour in Charlotte is something we can continue to plan on our calendars?
Charlie, I'll answer as I have before. I bet my career on it. I'm hopeful that it takes place. So, I'm hoping we have annual golf here for a long time.
He is the tournament director of the Wells Fargo Championship. That's Gary Soba. I'd also like to thank Ryan Ballingy with thegolfnewsnet.com and golf historian Peter Kessler for their time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what in the Sam heck we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice most weeks, just minutes after this terrestrial radio version of the show finishes airing. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. And on the page right now, links to a great story on Gary Player reflecting on his win at Carnoustie 50 years later, and why Tony Romo turned down the prize money, more than 150 grand, from his win at the American Century Celebrity event last week. Hey, weather-wise, look, you know the drill. It's sunny, warm, and the summer days are long, so it should be a pretty dang good weekend to tee it up and let this game continue to haunt our soul and break our hearts. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.